Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. An alarming new record. More than 150,000 new COVID cases in a single day as the pandemic's troubling resurgence continues. Then moving forward, President-elect Biden focuses on the transition as the dangers posed by President Trump's denial become clearer. Plus, critical care. The coronavirus complicates efforts to counteract alarming child mortality rates in Pakistan.
These children are not dying because of pneumonia or diarrhea. These children are dying because the society has yet to decide that their lives are worth saving.
And it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks analyze the president's refusal to concede and what a Joe Biden administration could look like. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. COVID-19 set all kinds of records in the U.S. this week, and none was good. Just days after passing 100,000 new cases a day, the U.S. reported 153,000 yesterday. More than 67,000 people are hospitalized, a record for a third straight day. The country has averaged nearly 1,000 deaths a day for the past week. The overall death toll so far, at least 243,000. States are under huge pressure. In North Dakota, hospitals are so busy, the governor will allow healthcare workers who tested positive to treat some COVID patients if the workers have no symptoms. Minnesota, Oregon, and other states issued new restrictions on bars, restaurants, and social gatherings. New York City may stop in-person school classes on Monday, sending students back to distance learning. The Republican governors of Ohio and Utah issued statewide mask mandates. This afternoon, President Trump spoke about the larger situation in the Rose Garden. He took credit for the development of vaccines to come, and he weighed in again on the question of a national lockdown.
Ideally, we won't go to a lockdown. I will not go. This administration will not be going to a lockdown. Hopefully, whatever happens in the future, who knows which administration it will be. I guess time will tell. But I can tell you this administration will not go to a lockdown. There won't be necessity. Lockdowns cost lives, and they cost a lot of problems. The cure cannot be, you got to remember, cannot be worse than the problem itself. And I've said it many times.
Let's look more closely at the costly impact of this surge and what the Biden administration might do differently. Amna Nawaz begins with the latest in Texas, home to 1 million cases to date.
Judy, Texas is also struggling with a big surge, in particular in the border city of El Paso, home now to one out of every six cases in the state. Hospitals there have added extra tents for bed capacity. Mobile morgues now sit outside the medical examiner's office, which this week dealt with more than 150 deaths. And all this comes as a partial county lockdown has been extended. Dr. Joel Hendricks is the chief medical officer at the University Medical Center there, and he joins me now. Dr. Hendricks, welcome to the NewsHour, and thank you for making the time. Let's start by telling people a little bit about what steps you've had to take, what adjustments you've had to make there to meet that surge of patients coming in.
So within the city of El Paso and with all the other hospitals, we've created almost 600 new beds to be able to take care of this influx of new patients that we're taking care of. Understand, we also take care of other patients, those who need other medical conditions and have to be in our hospital, as well as our COVID population.
And Dr. Hendricks, I recall an expert telling me weeks ago the problem wouldn't just be beds with the surge, it would also be staffing. You need doctors and nurses and support teams who have that expertise in intensive care. How have you been able to meet that need, the staffing need?
So you're right. And so we are isolated out here, and there is a limited number of bodies, if you will, to take care of it. But we've been very fortunate because the governor has sent an extraordinary amount of resources to us, as well as nurses, doctors, and it's been a process of integrating those within our systems with all the hospitals. We have the military. They've embedded doctors into our hospital to help us meet the demands of taking care of these extraordinarily sick patients.
What about what's fueling this surge? We've heard so much about pandemic fatigue, about small gatherings of friends and family, from the cases and the patients you see. What's driving the surge in El Paso?
Well, that's a good question. And I don't think I have all the answers. I've heard some good explanations. Certainly, we talk about some of the younger population having the majority of the infections and unfortunately passing it on. We talk about gatherings. We talk about restaurants, big box stores. These are different areas that they have talked to us about. And it's unsure if that's the exact number. We are our border. We are lying just north of Mexico, and we also lie underneath New Mexico. So there's a lot of cross-cultural traffic that continues.
Now, we mentioned earlier that a partial lockdown has been extended. There's been some back and forth from county officials and the mayor and others about whether or not to have additional restrictions. In your view, medically speaking, would a lockdown help to curb the surge you're seeing now?
So I think it comes down to individual responsibility, that they need to know that even with a lockdown, you still have family gatherings, those type of things. And it's a matter of preventing the virus to spread. So individuals need to use their masks. They need to follow the recommendations that are generally proposed to help slow down and stop this virus. These have been utilized throughout the world, and we want to make sure that our citizens, our individuals, prevent that transmission. That's our goal. How you do that is can be a political process. But from our point, if they don't get sick, they don't end up in our hospital, and therefore we will have the resources to take care of everybody.
If people don't take those steps, what are you worried you'll see in the next weeks and months ahead?
You know, obviously, there are limited resources in anything that you do. And if we are able to get control of that, then we're able to handle what we have, take care of our other patients, and move forward. We have not gotten into the flu season yet, and certainly the resources we have now may not be here later because of other hotspots that can occur either in our state or around the country.
That is Dr. Joel Hendricks from the University Medical Center in El Paso, Texas. Doctor, we thank you for your time and we wish you luck ahead.
Thank you very much.
The problems we're hearing about in Texas and elsewhere are likely to be just as bad, possibly even worse, in a number of states this winter when President-elect Biden takes office. This week, the president-elect announced a COVID task force to prepare specific plans for the months ahead and assess what can be done differently. Dr. Vivek Murthy is a co-chair of that task force. He's a former U.S. Surgeon General, and he joins us now. Dr. Murthy, thank you very much for being with us. We have just heard about the stresses they are under in Texas, extraordinary measures they are taking. What will President-elect Biden be able to do as soon as he takes office to curb this surging pandemic?
Well, thanks, Judy. It's good to be with you. And the situation in the country is really dire right now. We have cases that are exploding. We have hospitals that are filling up. We have a death toll that's unfortunately marching upward. And it's imperative that we act immediately. President-elect Biden has put together a series of plans when he was running for office that laid out how he would respond. And part of the job of the committee, the group that he's put together on COVID that I'm a part of, is to take these plans and put a finer point on them to, in fact, use the latest science to inform them. But I can tell you what they'll generally center around. They'll center around some basic principles that involves stopping the spread of the virus, reopening safely, and protecting the hardest hit populations with an eye toward rebuilding public trust as a foundation for this approach. The way that we're going to do this is we're going to have to focus on a number of components, including expanding testing capacity so that we can do surveillance and diagnostic testing. We're going to have to manufacture enough PPE or protective equipment so our nurses and doctors and hospitals don't run out of masks. We're going to need a solid plan for vaccine distributions. We're going to need to encourage the public to use masks because they work to prevent the spread. But above all, Judy, we're going to have to rebuild public trust by communicating honestly, by leading with science, and by ultimately delivering results.
Number of things there I want to ask you about. But first, I want to repeat what President Trump said just moments ago at the White House. He said he has no plans while he's in office to impose a national shutdown. He said, I don't know what the next president, whoever it is, suggesting it could be Mr. Biden will do. Can you rule out a national shutdown by the Biden administration?
I actually think that we should be thinking about this in a slightly different way than we did in the spring. In the spring, the talk was about shutting down or not. But we've learned a lot since the spring about how this virus spreads and about how to reduce spread. And what that's allowed us to do is really to imagine a model that's more like a dial that you turn up and down in terms of increasing restrictions and decreasing restrictions based on how you're doing. And those measures need to be specific, but they also need to be targeted. What you see are happening in New York City right now is they're actually targeting down to the zip code level and determining what measures need to be implemented on that zip code level instead of saying, let's just shut down everything in the city. And so that's the approach that we have to take. The goal here is to shut down the virus so that we can, in fact, open up society, especially our schools, because we know the cost of closing them down is extraordinarily high.
But how is that different from what's already been tried in this country, where different cities, different states have handled it locality by locality? It's the way Europe has handled it. And now Europe is having to go to a shutdown. I mean, what gives you confidence that this approach will work?
Well, I'll say first that we have to approach this pandemic and all pandemics with humility. You know, we are learning each and every day about this virus. So we can never say 100% something is going to work. But here's why I think that we can in fact, do better down the line. One is because you do see localities and states actually developing their own alert systems that tell them when to pull the trigger, if you will, on different precautionary measures. But there's confusion that we're hearing often from governors and from mayors. What they want is actually a national system of alert levels that they can tinker with and tailor a bit on their own, but one that gives them guidance. But the other challenge we have, Judy, is that it's been tough for a lot of people to stick to this guidance, and I understand why.
Let me ask you about a vaccine. As you know, announcement from Pfizer this week that they have something they think is very effective with FDA approval. They are saying they could distribute millions of doses in, we were hearing it again at the White House just now, in December, more in January. Do you have confidence that the Trump administration will handle this vaccine distribution fairly and correctly?
Well, we certainly hope that they will do a good job in getting the vaccine out quickly, fairly, equitably. But the truth is, this is going to take more than just a couple of months. First of all, we don't have a vaccine that has received authorization yet. We had data that was issued earlier this week from Pfizer about their candidate showing that it was, in fact, quite promising. But we've got to still wait for them to submit that vaccine for authorization. We've got to wait for the FDA to review the data. And once that happens, then we can start down the process of actually distributing this vaccine. But that's a process that's going to take months. And that's why it's going to be very important for President-elect Biden and his team to do what we've been doing, which is to build those plans and to be ready to execute the distribution of a virus on day one.
But rough timetable, though. Do you think most Americans will be able to get the vaccine in the spring? Dr. Fauci threw out late April the other day as a date. Does that sound reasonable to you, that more than frontline workers and more than the most vulnerable will be able to get it in the spring?
Well, I'll tell you this, Judy, we don't know yet what the exact time frame will be. And part of the reason is it depends in part on when the vaccine is ultimately approved. It depends in part on the logistics of distribution, which means not just getting it to the states, but all of the downstream processes after that of ensuring that the doctor's offices, hospitals, and other entities are ready to actually deliver that vaccine. Our hope, optimistically, is that by the spring, we can start getting it beyond the first tier of individuals, which would be healthcare workers and people in congregate settings like nursing homes. But that's a best estimate. I think we should be prepared for the fact that it may take the better part of 2021 for us to get the vaccine to everyone in the country and potentially beyond that, depending on how this process goes.
And I wanted to ask you about that because many Americans are growing weary of this, as you said a moment ago. How do you inspire, encourage, urge Americans for their own sake, for their family members and loved ones' sake, to continue to take these measures that they should take for the health and safety of all of us?
Well, Judy, I'm glad you asked that question because, look, I think all of us are having a hard time right now with where we are in this pandemic. It doesn't matter whether you are part of a big family or you're living on your own. It doesn't matter if you're wealthy or not so wealthy, all of us have had our lives turned upside down in some way, although many of us have struggled more than others. And I think in this moment, as hard and as fatigued, as people are, I think what's important for us to realize is that there is hope around the corner. We do have good data from the first vaccine candidate, and likely we'll have more vaccine candidates that turn up promising data in the months ahead. We have treatments that are starting to come onto the scene, which aren't game changers yet, but they do help to reduce complications from this virus. And we are getting better at figuring out how to prevent the spread of this virus. So we are learning more. We are going to be able to overcome this pandemic, but it's just going to take us a little bit more time. So we've got to lean on each other and support one another. There is no shame in feeling fatigued or feeling distraught about where we are. A lot of us are feeling that, and we've got to lean on each other and look out for each other during this very difficult time.
Dr. Vivek Murthy, who is co-chair of President-elect Biden's Coronavirus Task Force, thank you.
Thanks so much, Judy.
As we heard earlier this afternoon, President Trump made his first public statement since Joe Biden was declared president-elect. But in the Rose Garden, Mr. Trump made no direct comments about the results. We turn now to NewsHour's Yamiche Alcindor, who covers the White House, and Lisa Desjardins for an update on the transition of power. Yamiche, to you first. So fill us in on what the president did have to say in the Rose Garden.
Well, these were the first public remarks by President Trump since he was declared the projected loser of the 2020 election. And he came really, really close to acknowledging that there might be a Biden administration, but stopped short of actually saying those two words together. We haven't heard him acknowledge that at all. Instead, the president wanted to talk about the coronavirus vaccine, and he wanted to be congratulated by the fact that he believes 20 million Americans will be able to get the vaccine come this December. He didn't acknowledge, though, that his own actions might be slowing down the coronavirus vaccine from getting to millions of Americans, because experts say his refusal to have an official transition start is stopping the Biden administration, Biden transition team, from going in and seeing exactly what needs to take place with that vaccine. Another thing, I've been talking to White House officials, some of them on the coronavirus task force, and they tell me that they don't want to get out ahead of the president. So as everyone is waiting for the president to process, all sorts of things hang in the balance, including the response to the coronavirus pandemic of this administration and of the next administration.
And Lisa, we know that the Biden team has been saying that it's so important for them to have the latest information on the vaccine. He's now been president-elect for a week as of tomorrow. Where do things stand?
Well, when you talk to the Biden transition team, they tell you something that a lot of folks know. This is a man, the president-elect, who literally knows his way around the Situation Room. He's very well equipped and has a large and long understanding of national security in general. But they really need those real-time threat assessments in order for them to plan out how to respond to them when Biden takes over in January. That said, they're not yet planning to sue or take legal action to get that transition authority. Talking to one senior advisor today, they told me they think that the General Services Administration will come around and will ultimately give them that authority. There are others who are worried about it, though, like former White House Trump Chief of Staff John Kelly, who said today that that lack of national security briefings for incoming President-elect Biden is a real national security threat. One other thing, Judy, amidst all this, the Biden transition is hiring. They are still holding interviews for top positions. We expect more announcements on personnel next week. I'm told not cabinet positions, but other White House positions. A lot of us waiting, of course, to see White House press secretary, things like that.
And meantime, Yamiche, we know that the Trump campaign is winding down, people starting to leave. Any indication yet that the president may be getting closer to conceding?
Well, President Trump remains defiant, but we did get a little bit more information on what the timeline could be of all of this. The president told the Washington Examiner newspaper that it could be 2 to 3 weeks of him continuing these legal battles. He said, quote, never bet against me. He also was talking about the legal battles there, saying that he sees evidence. But Judy, the judges that are seeing these cases have been throwing them out one after another. At least a dozen cases from the Trump campaign have been dismissed. Today, we saw Pennsylvania and Michigan, number of lawsuits being thrown out. In Michigan in particular, a judge said there was no credibility, the Trump campaign was not meeting their burden of proof, and that they were presenting generalized arguments. Now, my sources and people that I've been talking to in the Biden campaign as well as the Trump campaign, they say this could all be really heading to a head in December, because that's when the Electoral College votes. It's after that that people on the Biden campaign say things will be ratcheted up and there will be possibly an illegal square off then.
And back to you, Lisa, on the Biden transition. We've heard a little bit about appointments, the White House Chief of Staff we learned the other day. But what are you learning in terms of what they'll do on day one? We just spoke with Dr. Vivek Murthy, who's working on the COVID task force. But what else are we learning? Are you learning?
For the Biden transition, these things are hand in hand. They're thinking about who can enact their policy more than necessarily the person's resume. So when you're talking about those policies on day one, as we heard from now newly appointed or newly named White House Chief of Staff, he will be Ron Klain. He said last night things that they plan to do on day one are pretty big. Things like re-entering the Paris Climate Accord, rejoining the World Health Organization. On immigration, we're talking about things like a status for DACA, those dreamers who were brought here as children, and perhaps even some orders about deportations, maybe even freezing deportations while they study the issue further. So this operation is right now getting that paperwork ready, even as it hires people to implement those policies at the same time. And that's my cat.
Nothing slowing down. We heard that. Good to know. All right. Lisa Desjardins reporting on the Biden camp. Yamiche Alcindor at the White House. Thank you both.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about another podcast, Last Day from Lemonada Media. Last Day is Lemonada Media's series that zooms in on someone's last day of life and then zooms out to help you understand a broader epidemic. Hosted by Stephanie Whittles-Wax, the first season unpacked the opioid crisis. Season 2 is about the suicide epidemic. You'll listen to people sharing their deeply personal stories, with Stephanie asking everyone she meets along the way, how did we get here and what could we have done differently? You can subscribe to Last Day wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the day's other news, stocks rallied on Wall Street over optimism about progress on a COVID-19 vaccine. The Dow Jones Industrial Average soared 399 points to close at nearly 29,480. The Nasdaq rose 120 points, and the S&P 500 closed at a record high for the first time since September, adding 48 points. At least 7 people have died in North Carolina in flash flooding triggered by Tropical Storm Eta. Roads and bridges were swept away after some places were inundated with as much as 10 inches of rain. One person also died in Florida. Meanwhile, Tropical Storm Iota has formed in the Caribbean. It is expected to become a hurricane late Sunday as it barrels toward Central America. The death toll from the catastrophic typhoon in the Philippines has now risen to at least 42 people. 20 others are still missing. More than 400,000 people were evacuated. Cleanup efforts are underway now that floodwaters have started to recede. Residents who were able to return to their homes found virtually everything coated in mud. In Ethiopia, the United Nations is warning of war crimes amid conflict between the central government and regional rebel leaders. Hundreds of civilians have been killed in the northern Tigray state this week in what Amnesty International has called a massacre. The UN estimates more than 14,500 refugees have fled to nearby Sudan. They spoke of the heartbreak of leaving their homeland.
I left my mother in a church. She's an elderly woman. My brother is blind. We left him there as well. There's no food or water. Everyone ran away, and on the way, we found murdered people with weapons and axes and knives. That's why we ran. What were we to do? We want to save ourselves.
Heartbreaking. Refugees said they witnessed bombings by government warplanes and civilian deaths in Tigray, but the Ethiopian government insisted that they are striking only military targets of Tigrayan forces. Seven pharmaceutical companies leading the worldwide search for a COVID-19 vaccine have been targeted by cyber attacks. Microsoft said today that it detected intrusions from state-backed Russian and North Korean hackers. Most attempted to steal login credentials. Microsoft was able to block a majority of the attacks, but acknowledged some of the break-in efforts were successful. The targeted companies were not identified. A historic first in Major League Baseball and the entire U.S. sporting world. Kim Ng has become the first female general manager of an MLB franchise after being tapped to lead the Miami Marlins. She's also believed to be the first female GM of a men's team in any of the major American sports leagues. The 51-year-old has spent her entire professional career with the MLB and has won three World Series. And a passing to note, football legend Paul Hornung died in Louisville, Kentucky, after a battle with dementia. Dubbed Golden Boy, the halfback led the Green Bay Packers to four NFL championships in the early 60s. He also won the 1956 Heisman Trophy in college at Notre Dame. And in 1986, he was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Paul Hornung was 84 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, the coronavirus complicates efforts to counteract alarming infant mortality rates in Pakistan. Mark Shields and David Brooks analyze the impact of the president's refusal to concede. We remember some of the many remarkable lives lost to COVID-19, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
A new study from the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control shows that measles cases in 2019 reached their highest number in 23 years. Health officials blame the rise on a significant drop in vaccination rates. We may soon see other preventable diseases spike, too. Childhood immunization rates have dropped sharply during the pandemic. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro began reporting today's story early this year, focusing on one group working to improve child health in Pakistan. It is part of Fred's series, Agents for Change. And a warning, some viewers may find graphic images in this segment unsettling.
We filmed these images just before the pandemic, outside a Karachi public hospital one typical morning, where hundreds of people waited for hours just to see a doctor. Months into the pandemic, the throngs are still lining up, many people not wearing masks. Despite that, the virus seems to be under control in Pakistan.
Pakistan has been very lucky that COVID has not devastated it like most other countries. And the jury is still out on why we have been lucky.
I reached Asan Rabbani on his phone recently. Back in January, we visited a project he leads in hospitals across Pakistan that's aimed at reducing the country's high infant mortality rate. After a spike in COVID infections in June, public health experts credit targeted localized lockdowns and luck for helping flatten the curve in Pakistan, a crowded nation of 220 million. That's been a huge relief in an underfunded, overwhelmed public health system.
There's a child been brought in critical care.
Rabbani heads the Child Life Foundation, started 7 years ago by a group of business leaders who stepped in to help the decrepit public hospitals deal with emergency care for young children. One out of every 20 Pakistani children doesn't make it to age 5. The vast majority die before their first birthday.
These children are not dying because of pneumonia or diarrhea. These children are dying because the society has yet to decide that their lives are worth saving.
He says pneumonia and diarrhea are treatable and preventable through better hygiene and immunization. But it's public indifference that allows them to claim hundreds of thousands of children's lives every year in Pakistan.
I'll tell you what's the most difficult part when I go to ER, the wailing of mothers. I mean, it shakes you when you see a mother in pain.
On the front lines are staff of the neonatal intensive care unit, the nurse who disconnects life support from an infant who didn't make it, the doctor who must disclose this to an exhausted mother. Daunting as the images are, the recovery rate has greatly improved since Child Life set up this pediatric emergency room, particularly among the most critical patients.
The survival rate was less than 20%. Now it has quadrupled to 90% plus. And it happens because of training, availability of doctors, systems, medicines, and a second doctor's opinion through telemedicine.
Cameras in every resuscitation unit are connected to doctors in this virtual exam room. They work 24/7 with frontline providers across Child Life's network of hospitals.
Blood pressure is up, repeat.
The pandemic has added stress and expense. Things like personal protective gear and plexiglass separators in the cramped neonatal intensive care units. And Child Life staff had its own COVID issues.
We had 28 people of our staff who contracted COVID, but the show went on.
Fortunately, all the staffers recovered. While Pakistan overall has been spared, this fear the pandemic has made children more vulnerable to easily treatable infections that come from the conditions so many live in. Immunization rates were already low in Pakistan, and they've dropped 25% during the pandemic.
That's a very real risk, especially for things like typhoid and measles and even polio. And WHO fears that we may have gone back a couple of years to get back to the same level of immunizations.
That could mean more patients like this 7-year-old boy brought in during our earlier visit, unconscious and shivering uncontrollably. Doctors suspected it was meningitis, something that's easily prevented with a vaccine that's recommended in infancy in developing countries. Two injections in quick succession stabilize his condition. For Dr. Zareen Kazmi, the next challenge was to coax his parents to consent to a spinal tap, extracting a sample of spinal fluid to confirm the diagnosis and inform future treatments. They listen and ask to have a family consult.
After 10 minutes, he came back and he said, no, sorry, we are not allowing you.
They'd heard of a case where a spinal tap was fatal, they told her. Their decision could put the boy at risk for a range of future complications. The problem is not just the parents' lack of education.
It basically boils down to trust.
Exactly.
And a lot of patients here don't trust the system.
Yes.
Child Life tries to build that trust by building relationships beyond the emergency visit. Parents' phone numbers are recorded when they come in, so text reminders can be sent when the children need shots, particularly important now with the pandemic. On our pre-pandemic visit, Fatma Zulfikar told us her 4 children are up to date on their shots. Still, she recently had to rush her then 7-month-old Khadija into the emergency room with acute diarrhea and vomiting. The problem is not poor hygiene, she says, but poverty itself.
We have 4 families that share this space. It's hard to maintain cleanliness and hygiene. She's a child. She's small. She crawls around, picks up stuff, puts it in her mouth. Life is very tough. We've got nothing.
If you live in a lane which has 20 houses and every third house had a child under 5 die, you believe that children die. So if you reduce infant mortality through preventive measures, through curative measures, people will have fewer children.
There's hardly a higher priority, he says, in what is already the world's 5th most populous nation. For the PBS NewsHour, this is Fred DeSanLazaro.
Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. And now to the analysis of Shields and Brooks. That is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. Hello to both of you on this Friday night. We haven't seen you since the election was declared. Joe Biden was declared the winner, Mark. So what do you make? We have to ask you, what do you make of the result and how some of these final states went, Arizona, Georgia, and the others?
Well, I think I predicted every one of them, Judy. No, I guess I'm not surprised. Surprised at the margin and the margin that was so close. And I think that in retrospect, the campaign of Donald Trump deserves enormous credit for identifying and motivating and turning out voters who had were not regular voters and gave Trump the number of votes he had and probably made the difference almost surely in the Republicans picking up House seats and in retaining the Senate. But the victory, it was rather remarkable to be here in Washington at the time. It had a VJ Day quality to it. I mean, not that dimension, the victory over Japan in World War II, but it's sort of a sense of public exhilaration, people smiling, just of goodwill, which had to be rather unsettling for the president as he came back from the golf club, because he had to go right by it in Lafayette Park. And to see this sort of sense of gaiety and New Year's Eve festivity that was felt.
David, what did you make of the result, of the call, the final call, how it ended?
Well, there was people playing Glory Days, a Springsteen song in my neighborhood, too. And so at least in urban America, there's a lot of joy. 5 points is a pretty good victory, bigger than I thought it would be on election night or thereabouts. And so it's a good Biden win. I happen to think Joe Biden was the only Democratic nominee who could have won this election. There was a lot more pro-Trump support than we thought. There was not a great pro-Democratic Party generic support as much as we thought. I think the Democrats need to get over this idea that they are the emerging majority party. This idea has been around because of demographic things or other things. And there's been an assumption that demography is on our side. And I think it's just time to accept that's just not going to happen. We're going to be a pretty 50-50 country. I'll believe a change when I see it. And it's becoming more polarized on education, with Democrats becoming the party more and more of the college educated, the Republicans becoming more and more the college, the high school educated, and geography. The urban-rural divide is wider than ever. And so we are just locked into some sort of either gridlock or compromise. We'll see, but it's 50-50 almost.
Mark, what about that? I mean, you mentioned that the Democrats didn't do as well as they thought they would in the Senate or in the House. They lost seats in the House.
No, that's right, Judy. David makes a good point. This has been a year of expectations, if you recall, and raised expectations. Donald Trump raised the expectations going into the first debate that Vice President Biden was non-compos, that he couldn't finish a sentence, that he would fall asleep on the stage. None of which, of course, happened. Vice President Biden handled himself well, prevailed, and that may have been the defining event of the fall campaign. Democrats had expectations, great expectations about winning the Senate, about enlarging the House majority, all of which came up quite short. I think the argument that one party control is strong, that there was a resistance to that. The Republicans made the case. And I think just language like defund the police really came back to haunt Democrats and hurt them in suburban and marginal districts. And I think you'll see a fractiousness and a division. It's already there within the Democratic House caucus, within the Democratic Party at large. Over this, there isn't a natural Democratic majority that is inevitable in the country. And I think that was a lesson to be learned on November 3rd.
So, David, is there a way to put a finer point on it? The country is divided, as you're both saying, there's not a natural Democratic majority. So what is it? What do we have?
Well, we probably have gridlock, but I hope not. You know, I spent a bunch of this week calling around the Senate, speaking to senators like Mitt Romney, and ask him, is there any way to get 60 votes around some issues just so we can pass some things and help some people? And Romney came up with a whole bunch of topics, the Dreamers, the immigration, some budget stuff, some healthcare stuff, prescription drugs. He said, sure. And then I talked to other aides, and they came up with national service, infrastructure. And so there's at least a eagerness on the part of a lot of senators to actually vote for legislation, something they have not been allowed to do under Mitch McConnell, and pass things. Will McConnell allow votes to come to the floor? Will he cooperate and play ball? Well, nobody would bet on that. But I'm struck by a desire to get out of the stuckness that has marked legislative bodies for the past couple of years.
Interesting about what Romney said. But, you know, speaking of Mitch McConnell, Mark, he is staying with President Trump's insistence that he's not only within his rights to challenge the election, he's not conceding, that he needs to pursue every legal avenue. In fact, Republicans are virtually in lockstep. Only a few of them don't support the president. Lasting impacts of that? Is it just, are we going to be over it soon? What do you see?
Judy, that Donald Trump is going out as a sore loser. I think he's making a serious mistake, and his future obviously is not bright. I mean, you can talk about 24, but there's an awful lot of investigations and judicial action between now and 2024. Mitch McConnell is kind of fascinating. If you go back to December of 2008, which I did, and you're free to look at it, the Senate had a send-off for Joe Biden, who had just been elected vice president, and senators made their statements. Mitch McConnell wrote his own statement. It was quite moving and quite personal about Joe Biden, and that Joe Biden was the rare creature who could reach across the aisle to Jesse Helms, to Strom Thurmond, or to me, and he became my friend. I think this will be tested. I really do. I think he's awfully, he's key. He's important in this. And one thing that was lost in the campaign is that Joe Biden is one of the great retail politicians of this generation. He is wonderful with people of all sorts. He was deprived of that. We never saw it. We never saw him with people in the campaign. They ran a good campaign, a disciplined campaign. But I think when you get Joe Biden in the White House as president bringing those personal skills together, I think that the chances are improved. And I'm more optimistic, I guess, maybe than David is.
And David, I want to ask you about the Biden prospects, but just quickly on the president's refusal to concede, is this something that leaves a lasting scar, or does it go away quickly? What do you see?
Well, I think Trump has left a lasting scar. The whole entity, the whole entirety of the existential presence of Trump has left a lasting scar on our norms, on the way we feel each other, about the way the world looks at us. Dictators around the world are happy to see an American president denying election results. That gives them encouragement and gives them a set of norms they can hew to. You know, I expect him to go. You can feel the air coming out of the balloon, the stages of grief. Denial, then rage, and then acceptance, though with Trump there's more rage and more denial. But you feel the Republicans walking away, rightly or wrongly, just not wanting to get in front of the train and push him out. That's a wrong metaphor, but but you feel him losing losing momentum, and I do think he will eventually whimper out, probably without ever admitting defeat and probably without attending Joe Biden's inauguration. But that is the way the man is.
Mm. A lot of people wondering about that. And David, yeah. Oh. I just want to ask David on Biden's prospects to respond to Mark, what you said a moment ago.
Yeah, well, I'm maintaining my posture of unrealistic optimism. And so I do think there's some chance of actually working together. You look at the people Joe Biden is hiring, they're experienced. Ron Klain is chief of staff, experience at pandemic fighting, experienced at Washington. You look at the people running the task force, the COVID task force, Vivek Murthy, the former Surgeon General, Atul Gawande's on that task force. We're just getting an A-team. You know, with Trump, we never got the Republican A-team. With Biden, it looks like we're going to get the Democratic A-team. So that's got to make you feel good.
And I was struck, Dr. Murthy, when we talked to him a few minutes ago, used the term humility several times. Mark, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, I just following up on the point of President Trump. Here in Washington, Judy, power is the perception of power. If I think you've got power, and David thinks you've got power, people, you have power. And that's the reality now. You can feel the power has moved from Donald Trump to Joe Biden. The world is called, Erdogan is called, the only unheard of, Kim Jong-un is on the line. No, but he'll be writing a letter to Joe Biden. He and Putin are kind of the holdouts, the bitter enders. But that's the reality, that the power has left Donald Trump. And so the question is, when does that reality set in with him?
And David, to put a punctuation mark, you see it coming.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to, I don't know if it'll be before Inauguration Day, but, you know, Republicans are beginning to urge Trump to give Biden the press, the intelligence briefings. And so as they begin to do that, that's just part of a process of withdrawal.
And we will see about the inauguration. David Brooks, Mark Shields, on this Friday night, we thank you both so much.
Thank you.
As COVID-19 continues to take a heavy toll on our communities, we again take a moment to honor those who lost their lives to this deadly virus. Mario Aranda's life work was to empower people, his family said. Raised Mormon in Chihuahua, Mexico, Mario immigrated to Utah in 1959, where he met his wife of three decades. His work in linguistics then took him to Chicago, where he advocated for Latinos and promoted bilingual education. His marriage ended in the 1990s, and in Berkeley, California, Mario found love a second time. He and his partner had 20 years together. The spiritual father of seven enjoyed hiking, swimming, meditating, and like his mom, he was a voracious reader. Mario was 79. Those who knew 69-year-old David D. Swart Sr. described him as a simple man who worked hard every day for his family and friends. A lifelong resident of upstate New York, he served as a lieutenant and 30-year veteran of the Amsterdam Fire Department. When he wasn't putting out fires, he was making hot dogs at his restaurant, Dave's Dogs, and devoting time to his family. His son said Dave loved big and was a first responder in both work and spirit, always showing up for those in need. Salutacion Solon Fontanilla grew up in the Philippines wanting to go into medicine. In 1993, Salutacion, or Sally, moved to California to work in nursing. For more than two decades, Sally was a bedside nurse at St. Mary Medical Center, where her husband also worked. The two were high school friends in the Philippines and married in 2000. Described by her husband as sweet and laid back, Sally was 51 years old. Born and raised in Brownsville, Texas, 60-year-old Juan Carlos Rangel was known as the Fixer. Juan, who went by Charlie, fixed cars for a living. Neighbors and family called him the honest mechanic and said he never overcharged for the job. He shared his passion for machinery with his four daughters, teaching them about engines and welding. One of them went on to become a mechanical engineer. Jim Goulding served as a United Methodist chaplain, professor, and dean over his three decades at McMurray College in Jacksonville, Illinois. Jim continued teaching even in retirement. After the 9/11 attacks, he created courses on Islam, to foster dialogue and understanding of the religion in Madison, Wisconsin. Jim also led Sunday school classes and enjoyed traveling with his wife of 51 years. A beloved father and grandfather, Jim was 83 years old. Thank you to the family members who shared these stories, so important as we tell the lives of your loved ones. Our heart goes out to you, as they do to all those who've lost loved ones in this pandemic. No matter what age you are, it has undeniably been a year of many firsts. Between COVID and the election of the first woman vice president, 2020 will be a year for historians to examine and dissect for decades to come. Tonight, biographer and historian Janice Nimura shares her humble opinion on how we can all help shape the story that's taught to future generations. This essay is part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
I started keeping a journal in 11th grade. It was an assignment for English class, but once I got going, I discovered what all writers know. Most of the time, you write not to set down what you think, but to figure out what you have to say. What you've written becomes part of your personal history. I can go back to that green notebook and remember what it felt like to be 16. I've been keeping a journal ever since. You see, the rhetoric of powerful people can persist for millennia. But that kind of writing is a polished mask for an audience. Journals, on the other hand, are scribbled in private and full of naked feelings. They preserve the voices we don't usually hear, the very young, the elderly, the powerless. For biographers like me who seek treasure in archives, those are the most precious finds. And this is a critical moment to keep one. 2020 is a year none of us will forget, filled with grief, rage, anxiety, and confusion, and also determination, generosity, and hope. We have a lot to process, and what we write in this moment will capture it. We may not ever forget 2020, but our written voices will tell our great-grandchildren the story of right now, and possibly help them face the crises of the future. So keep a journal. Find a notebook, or jot notes on your phone. Write about what you had for dinner. Write about what makes you angry. Write about what you want. Or if you don't feel like writing, draw. Paste in a photo of your cousins on Zoom or of a protest or your best friend wearing a mask. On the first page of my 11th grade journal, I wrote, "This is just for me. Write like no one is watching." That is, write like no one is watching right now. Someday, a historian or your own great-grandchild may lift your notebook from a dusty shelf or open a file on a forgotten hard drive and read your words with growing excitement. They will hear your voice reacting to the turmoil of 2020, figuring out what to feel. And they will learn something from it, just as you learned something about yourself when you wrote it.
Such good advice from Janice Nimura. We thank you. And before we go tonight, I want to take a moment to remember my dear friend and co-anchor, Gwen Ifill. It's hard to believe tomorrow marks 4 years since she passed, because there have been so many days when we ask, what would Gwen do? She's inspired countless young journalists to keep up her legacy, and we are grateful many of them are today part of our NewsHour family. As we come close to the end of a busy year of news, we like to think that she's looking over our shoulder and smiling. And thankfully, that smile remains on a U.S. postage stamp that we expect to see a lot of over the holidays. Find it and put it on your notes and letters this Christmas. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Have a great weekend. Thank you. Please stay safe and good night.